Hey, it's Brandi Cruz. This bonus podcast is part of our 2024 election coverage, where all year we'll be bringing you in-depth interviews with candidates for public office. Today, it is Chad Magendanz, who is running to be the next superintendent of public instruction. Chad, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for inviting me, Brandi.
Why in the world would you want to run for this job? What is wrong with you?
Well, you know, my family has this tradition. We do our military service in the beginning. Mm-hmm. We have our career and family phase. And then we figure out how to pay it forward when we're done. My dad was a teacher for 14 years as his sunset career. And I found my way serving two terms in the legislature, president of the school board. And now as a teacher myself, I've seen a lot of the impact of the policies that have been made down in Olympia in the classroom. And I was called to go back and see if we can make another effort to repeat a lot of the successes we had with McCleary, yep, but more focused on policy this time.
Yeah, so let's go through your background a little bit. So you served in the Navy, unlike some people,
real nuclear submarine officer.
Yes, I was. I won't name names. So tell me what you did in the Navy.
I was a regular junior officer. I was ROTC at Cornell. And I went right into the submarine program, qualified, went to nuclear power school, and and got qualified silver and gold dolphins when I was out there. And then the last thing I did was qualify engineer. So my last tour was as assistant engineer, all Trident class. So the Georgia and the Henry M. Jackson were my two main ships.
When was your last year in the Navy?
Well, I served some reserve duty at the end, but my last active duty year was 94.
Gotcha. Yep. So you ended up in a career in education. Talk about why that is the route you decided to go.
Well, coming out of the Navy, I spent 20 years in tech. So I was 20 years at Microsoft.
Right. Yes.
Yep. And as a person who is interviewing people regularly for these tech jobs, I was kind of frustrated that we weren't giving our own kids the skills that I felt they needed to get those jobs. And so that became kind of a goal of mine, is to close that skills gap between what the tech sector needs and what we were providing them in school. And, you know, we're the most tech-dependent state in the nation. Almost 10% of our workforce is in high tech, more than any other state, even Washington, D.C. So I started getting involved as a PTA advocate, you know, going down to Olympia and testifying, as I noticed you did last week. I kind of got the bug, and so as a PTA rep, I became an outstanding PTA advocate that year, and then I was appointed to the school board, NISQA, and then elected subsequently, and then elected to president as the school board president of ISQA, 15th largest district in the state. And so that was basically what put me in line to be recruited for the legislature, and I actually announced on the day that the McCleary decision from the Supreme Court was announced, because I wanted to be part of that solution. And oh, did I get my wish.
Because that was a long battle. I mean, gosh, the big chunk of my first few years reporting here was all about fully funding education, fully funding education. So talk about that. I mean, in the legislature, so you've gone through, you know, PTA, school board, and now you find yourself in the legislature at one of the most consequential times for education in our state. So talk about what you dealt with.
Yeah, right off the bat, I was elected assistant floor leader and appointed to assistant ranking member of education. But then due to a series of events, I was ranking member of education very quickly and one of the lead negotiators for the whole McCleary remedy. I was also a co-chair of the oversight committee that reported our progress to the Supreme Court. And so there was just an endless series of committees and working groups that were involved in coming together for a bipartisan solution. Because if you recall, during my two terms, we had bipartisan control of legislature. Yeah. So we had to work together.
Isn't that crazy how that works?
You can find get common done. Ground. We were passing budgets with over 90% support. It was a very different era, and I consider myself lucky that I was able to serve during that time, because I felt like we ended up with a much better work product because of it.
Yeah. What do you think the impact of the McCleary decision has been on public education in Washington?
Well, by the numbers, we had 105% increase over 8 years. 44% of districts actually ended up with a net reduction in their levy rates, because it was two parts. We prioritized education in the beginning, and then we did this thing called the levy swap, where we'd swap local levy authority for state authority, and that was considered a more equitable way to distribute around the state, because there are rural areas of the state. I was kind of shocked when I looked at the numbers. We had areas at the time that had over $1 million for the median household value, and then other areas of the state where districts were in the 20s.
Yeah.
That kind of, diversity of financial situations really led to a lot of unintended consequences when it came to funding our schools. And so that was the focus, was to to double the funding over that period of time. And we did. We had it validated by the Supreme Court. And then I left the legislature and found that just about all that new money got spent in ways that I probably wouldn't have chosen to spend myself. And I'm very grateful as a teacher that we now have the highest compensated teachers in the nation, but I really wanted more focus on student outcomes and student programs. And I felt like we've fallen short on that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because you can throw money at a problem, but as we've seen in Washington State, more money doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have better outcomes. You know, I think in Washington right now, we spend on average $17,000 per pupil, but we're like at 50% or lower for math, reading, et cetera. So before we get to the state of our education system, you mentioned you're a teacher, Bellevue School District.
Yep.
What do you teach?
I've been teaching computer science full time for
Makes
the last
sense.
5 years.
Yeah.
And before that, I was actually a TEALS mentor. TEALS is a program we created in partnership with Microsoft back when I was on the school board in Issaquah. And it started with Issaquah High School and expanded to 625 schools across the continent. Most of the kids getting their AP exam in the state of Washington are doing it through a TEALS program right now. So it's been hugely successful. But, you know, we created the program. I felt like I should eat some of my own dog food, to coin a Microsoft phrase.
Yeah.
And so I volunteered as an instructor myself. Next thing you knew, I was, you know, subbing. And then I had an opportunity to get a full-time job while I was working on my credentials as a teacher. And I ended up finishing that up. I got a certificate in computer science as well as technology education, finished my master's degree, which I got to tell you, going to Central Washington, checking into a dorm in my 50s, that was a unique experience.
You had to check into a dorm?
Yeah, just for the summer. It wasn't long, but it was a little surreal.
Oh, that's funny. Well, that's in Ellensburg, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I met my husband in Ellensburg.
I'm heading there tomorrow, actually.
At the rodeo. So, yeah. Yes,
oh, the
it's
rodeo.
good hunting
it's a
ground
thing for
us.
Yeah.
Yes, we love it. So how do you like being a teacher? I mean, what do you like and not like about it?
I love it. I mean, the kids are what I love about it. Yeah, they're engaged. We're technically not a Title I school because we actually lost that status, I think, due to a lot of the cost of living.
And explain to people what Title I.
So a Title I is a high poverty school, and typically what districts will do is they'll designate one of their schools at the high, middle, and elementary level as a Title I school, so they can attract additional funding from the federal government.
Okay. Yeah.
And so a Title I school generally has high poverty. Relatively low test scores, things like that. And so there's the biggest opportunity to move the needle, if you will, as a teacher. So I'm grateful that I'm at that school. The kids are fantastic. They're hungry for the information. Our robotics team is awesome.
That's cool.
We're working on our fourth year going to the World Championships this year.
And are you an instructor?
I'm assistant coach for the robotics team.
Oh, my gosh,
team.
I love that.
It's fantastic.
That's really cool.
So the kids are fantastic. You know, sometimes I run into some policy decisions that make me think twice. Mm. And I say, that never would have happened when I was on the Issaquah School Board. We had, you know, segregated, you know, parent meetings and things like that were happening around the school. You know, a lot of the policies that came down as far as, you know, A's for all, for example, right during the COVID, it's hard to imagine that would have happened just 5, 6, 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And so some of the policies I think are kind of odd. And I think now seeing from the trenches, I see the impact on them. Now, for example, the A's for All policy, I saw just all my kids just check out because they knew they had an A, they didn't have to do anything else. I had to get really creative. I fell back on industry certified certifications. So I get a bunch of my kids with, you know, Java and Python certifications.
Yeah.
We get the Adobe certifications, Microsoft Office certifications. And that was a way to engage them, because one of the things I did when I was in the legislature is I dropped a budget proviso that asked the Education Research Data Center to look at the first 10 years of median salaries for the first 10 years of all the different majors you can take in a four-year university, two-year associate's degrees, and then we added apprenticeship programs and industry certifications.
Yeah.
And what we found out is that in CS and IT, you get more every single year for the first 10 years on, you know, median for an industry certification than you do for an associate's degree. So you could pay 2 years in a college.
Yeah.
And you end up coming out ahead with a free certification exam that you can take in school.
Yeah. And so getting kids back involved that way, as opposed to like giving them a reason to check out. Along those lines, something I'm curious about, because we live in our little podcast world, right? Where we get to pick and choose what we cover and, you know, highlight. We've done a lot of stories on what I think are ideologically driven decisions happening in schools. Help me understand and be honest, even if it hurts my feelings or makes me look like, you know, some crazy lady with a podcast. How much of a problem is that versus how much we talk about it. I mean, you live in that school environment every day. You've talked about a few things that have disappointed you. Are we overblowing the problem, or do we have a growing issue with ideology sort of becoming pushed on kids?
Are you thinking like critical race theory, trans ideology, things like that?
I mean, kind of, yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about gender ideology being taught in schools. It's BLM week, you know, in schools right now. And so this focus on things that aren't core to academics, how big of an issue is that?
Well, it's certainly really prevalent for professional development for teachers.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it a lot. You know, the first time I sat into a professional development session where I was told that everything I said had to be prefaced by, as a white man, immediately, you know, I was like, okay, why? Does that define me?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the opposite of what we're trying to teach our kids, right? And so I struggled with that.
Yeah.
But I do recognize, though, that there is systemic racism. I mean, there's certainly bias. I would agree with that. And there's plenty of research that shows that that still exists. Is it the same level that, you know, historically we've seen?
Right.
No, I mean, we're much better than we have been in the past, and I believe we can get better yet. My struggle has been with the priorities.
Okay.
I think what we're doing as far as equity and diversity is important, but not as important as core academics.
Yeah.
I want to see a refocus on academic achievement. And I'm sure you know the numbers. I mean, our you know, math scores, for example, that dropped from 50% before COVID to just 33%, and they've only recovered to 39%.
Yep.
You look at our NAEP scores, which allow us to compete, you know, compare our performance as a state to other states, and we've been steadily declining year after year for the last decade. And if you look at our current scores, and I particularly look at the fourth grade scores, because that's where I think the next generation of kids is going to be coming up through the program. And we're just average now. We are like right at the average for math and just a slightly above the average for reading. And we used to just lead the pack.
We should be. Average isn't good enough.
Yeah, average is not good enough for Washington State. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And so I think there was an expectation that this was going to be a temporary factor and it was going to just reset right after COVID. We haven't seen that reset. And there's been a lot of long-term effects that we haven't seen recover quickly. You know, for example, grade inflation is another thing that Seattle Times actually called out.
Yes. Yeah, grade inflation is interesting because you have this, you know, the grades that somebody is getting and then the test scores that they get. And you're seeing good grades and bad test scores. And it's because you have this inflation of grades and it's giving you a false perspective of how someone will do when they're tested. So a lot of the push I've seen for grade inflation has been, you know, no student who shows up should fail. You know, kind of that sentiment, or that there's a racial element of it in inflating grades. So what are you seeing happen in schools?
I'm seeing when everybody has an A, there's a huge stigma to not getting it, especially if you're trying to compete to get into a lot of these exclusive universities. So, you know, when I was a kid, we were on the 100-point system, right? So you could differentiate between an A, right? And it was easy to pick your, you know, valedictorian, salutatorian.
And by that, you mean like versus pass-fail?
Versus pass-fail, or even just regular old A's, B's, and C's, right? When you're on a 100 scale, there's a lot of differentiation between 90 and 100%. And so there wasn't this fear that kids have to take any course that might and give them a B. Yeah, because they might not get into the university if that's the case, right? So they play it very safe. And you'll see graduating class, you know, regularly we have, you know, 10 to 15 kids who have 4.0 GPAs, right? How do you differentiate among those kids to pick a valedictorian, salutatorian, things like that? And then if you're in a university's perspective, you're looking at a lot of different factors, which you should. I'm not proposing that we only look at standardized testing for university admission, but it's multiple factors. And one of those is grades. And the grades have become so inflated that there's just no way to differentiate anymore. So now you're relying on all these other factors.
Well, it seems to me that grade inflation is about helping people who are low achievers, right? I mean, not sort of flunk out. But, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it's like when you're trying to artificially inflate grades or do a pass-fail or no one who shows up can fail, to me it seems like that's being done for people who are low achievers to avoid that sort of stigma. But that seems like it would, if you're already a low achiever, that seems like it wouldn't do anything to encourage you to become a high achiever.
It certainly doesn't differentiate the high achievers.
Right.
Because it becomes so expected that everyone have a 4.0 GPA. Right. How do they differentiate at this point? Well, they got to go for industry certifications, a lot of after-school activities, extracurriculars become super important at that point.
Yeah.
And so you know, with a lot of universities just not even taking SAT or ACT mm-hmm. exams anymore, I was glad to see that Dartmouth.
Yeah, Dartmouth.
Yes, is
it's Dartmouth,
it
right?
It is Dartmouth, yes. But they are considering yes. that, and I hope that my alma mater will do it as well.
Yeah.
I sent my oldest to MIT, and I know that they were very much for using standardized testing, mm-hmm. and then they kind of, you know, went with the crowd, and I think they're reevaluating that as well. And so, it's a relatively straightforward way to differentiate your high achievers, but it shouldn't be the only measure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's an interesting question, because I've had the current superintendent of public instruction sitting where you are right now, and, you know, he kind of dismisses test scores as a really important gauge of student success. And he even admitted, I said, yeah, but if the test scores were really high, would you downplay those and say, well, that's not an indicator? And he said, well, that's a good point. You know, he would. If the test scores were super high, he'd be saying, look at our test scores. But since they're super low, it's like, oh, those don't really matter. So how important do you think test scores are for our public school students engaging how they're learning?
Well, I would certainly disagree that his position is that they have no meaning. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, they certainly do have meaning. And they are objective. I mean, they are colorblind. You take this exam, it's, you know, usually corrected by a machine, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is an objective measure of your academic achievement. You know, and admittedly, some kids do have test anxiety, and that's going to be a huge problem for them, and we need to work with them to find other means of evaluating their academics. But, you know, for most kids, I think it's an easy metric for what we can use. And I'm not really trying to judge the kids as much as I'm trying to judge the system.
Yeah.
I want to know if our schools are achieving. I want to know if our system is set up for success, because I really want to look at the trends from year to year. And when I see those NAEP trends, we're just continually going down as we're throwing a lot more investment into our public school systems.
Yeah.
I was really expecting the opposite trend. And it all can't be attributed to COVID.
No, it can't. And you said something that actually a commenter of ours had a good point about. We were talking about test scores and how important they are. And they said they're important to tell us whether our schools are doing a good job of teaching kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a much better way to look at it than are the kids doing a good job of, is it at the kid or is it the school? And so putting that burden on the school to make sure you're teaching kids what they need to do, what you need to for them to do well, I think is a really, really healthy way to look at it. I want to ask you a couple wedge questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sure you're excited about these. On the ideology front, as I said, we're in Black Lives Matter in Schools Week, and we've looked at some of the curriculum around that. Do you believe that public schools in Washington should be recognizing Black Lives Matter Week in schools, or even Pride, having a Pride Month or Pride Week in schools?
So it's Black History Month, I think you're mm-hmm. referring to. I'm not aware of a Black Lives Matter
in School Week is something
new.
That is, yeah. I mean, Black History Month is different.
I
think we would agree. That's probably fine. Even when
month,
I was in school,
yes.
But there's a Black Lives Matter in School Week, which is a product of the BLM movement. And it is something that a few districts in our state are, they put out something to parents. Here's what we're going to talk about. Here's some of the books and reading. And it is specific to, I guess, what I consider a political movement.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have Pride celebrations in schools as well. I mean, what space is there for that stuff, and where does it go too far?
I don't think it belongs if it's a particular organization.
Hmm.
The school that I walk into every morning has Black Lives Matter posted across the floor, window by window in the top. It's been that way since 2020. Obviously, the sentiment is very popular in our community mm-hmm. and in our school, and I have no issue with that. But the organization itself has some baggage, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Yes.
And
they spend money on mansions. And
they do.
Giving money to their loved ones and boyfriends. So, yes.
And so my feeling is, if you can separate the organization, if you're promoting an organization, that's when we get into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they were to, you know, promote a specific political party, for example,
right.
or even like a, you know, a group within that party, that's when you're using public resources to reinforce an organization. And I just don't think that's appropriate, particularly in our schools. As we work through a lot of the racial tensions right now, I think it's more important than ever that our schools find common ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the location where everyone needs to be comfortable sending their kids to school, right? No matter what their religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, all those things, we have to do the same thing we were doing in schools that we were doing in the budget when we were in a bipartisan legislature. We had to find what everybody could agree on.
Yeah.
Right. And what I feel everybody can agree on right now is academic achievement, career skills, and your basic civics, the kind of thing that you would get on a citizenship test.
Yeah.
That's what we need to focus on, because the rest can be very divisive.
Yeah. Well, and another issue, and again, I had the current superintendent sitting there, and we had just done a story about this issue around gender ideology and some of the policies across the state. And there had been, you know, an instance where there's this blanket policy that if a kid wants to identify as a different name or a different gender, and they don't want to tell their parents, they can come to school, they can use a different name and a different gender, and it's the expectation that the school does not share that information mm-hmm. with a parent. And the concern that that brought up to me is it creates this kind of secretive environment where the teacher's expected to keep a secret from the parent, the kids are expected to keep a secret from a parent, and all the while this parent has no clue that this huge thing is happening in their kids' lives. And I could not get an answer from Chris Reichdahl about whether he was supportive of something like that or not. What would your position on something like that be from a policy perspective?
Well, the memo came from his office, so I hope that he instructed the OSBI, his own mm-hmm. office, to make sure the memo reflected his current position. That, to me, was the straw that broke the camel's back.
For
That's
you.
What decided mm-hmm. for me to run for superintendent of public instruction. Because I'm a big believer in the Constitution. I believe what he did was unconstitutional. You know, the Supreme Court has recognized that parents have a fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of their children, and that right should not be interfered with unless the parent is deemed unfit. Hmm. They're very clear in that, in multiple cases that have made that point. Okay, so it's not a explicit yeah. constitutional right, but it is implicit based on case law. And so as a teacher, I see myself in partnership with parents to help educate their kids.
Yeah.
You know, with 150 kids coming through my classroom every day, I can't possibly know each one of them the way their own parents would. Okay. And this presumption of guilt, that's what really sticks in
parents
my craw.
Parents must be bad.
Exactly. I mean, to be deemed unfit, there's a due process we have to work through to get there, mm-hmm. right? And this assumption that any information that I would give a parent that had not been deemed unfit might jeopardize the child because they were a danger to their own child, I just don't see the justification for that.
Yeah.
I like to assume the best out of my parents until proven otherwise, and then I have a responsibility as a first reporter to make sure that those are addressed with CPS.
Right. Well, if they're abusing their kids, there's already a law for that. You can't abuse your kids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I took great issue with that policy when it came down, and I don't believe we should be deceiving parents in any way. I also would challenge his premise that this is private medical information.
Mm-hmm.
If we're using these names and pronouns throughout class, other students are seeing it, that's not private anymore.
Right. Private just from the parent.
Exactly.
The only one we're keeping that secret from is the parent. And I agree with that. It's like, and it does go back to something you said, which is the assumption is that a parent can't be trusted with that mm-hmm. information. Everyone else can be trusted with it. Teacher, fellow students, parents of those students, everyone else can be trusted with it. But a parent, that information in the hands of a parent is going to go bad for a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just such a common sense thing to be like, no, that's ridiculous. Like, I'm a good parent and I deserve to know what's happening with my kid. Don't keep secrets from me. So there'll be no secrets if Chad is the OSPI head.
No, not with
secrets.
Parents. They
yeah.
they have that fundamental right. Now, it's a double-edged sword. You know, as we saw just this week, a mother was convicted of a crime her son had committed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we're responsible for our children as well as we have a right to, you know, the care, custody, and control of mm-hmm. our children as well. So we've got to balance that out.
Yeah. Well, you bring it up there. So let's talk about it. School shootings.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, they're a tragedy. I think whenever you talk about this, people are like, oh, you want kids to die. And it's like, no, nobody wants kids to die. Like, let's have a real human adult conversation about this. They are rare, but they do happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's one side that kind of wants to approach that by banning the firearm. And then there's another side that thinks, well, let's harden our schools. I mean, what do you do? What do you do? And I know some of that would be out of your hands. It would be legislatively, what do we do? But what do you think is the solution to not just school shootings in the traditional sense that the news talks about, but in Tacoma, for instance, we've mm-hmm. had some issues with, you know, crime and criminal activity happening in and around schools. How do we protect kids in a place they should be safe?
When Uvalde happened, a lot of my teachers, we got together and we're like, well, what would we do mm-hmm. if that were the situation here? And a lot of us felt relatively powerless to do anything about it. We're not allowed to have any weapons in the school, which, you know, kind of makes sense for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But our solution was baseball bats. I have a baseball bat in my classroom right next to the door. So maybe I'll get one good whack in if somebody decides to come into my classroom. God, I hope it never comes to that.
That's so sad.
But we go over a lot of training. One of the things we're supposed to do is find a spot for the kids to hide in the room. Mm-hmm. We try to escape if we can first, you know, but if we have to hide, last resort was we would actually fight. But a lot of the things that are just kind of a modern school is going to have, I have an entire glass wall in my classroom, right? We're not going to hide very effectively there. Mm. Okay. And it's that fishbowl feeling. I had an actual security alert that happened when I was in Issaquah once, and it was after school hours, and it wasn't a drill. They thought they had someone walk in with a gun case. Oh. Turned out to be an umbrella. He was wearing cami. So it threw people. But, you know, there was that moment when you're locking down the school and the kids don't know where to go because it's after hours. Mm-hmm. And so they just pushed all of us into the gym. And I remember another Navy veteran, you know, we made eye contact and we said, fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
Because it just felt like we were so vulnerable in that position. Yeah. There was very little we could do. My personal opinion is that the SRO program needs to come back and come back strong. When I was president of the Issaquah School Board, King County cut the funding for the SRO program. And we had one high school that was actually in unincorporated King County.
Yeah.
And we would split it 50-50 with them. Well, we just picked up the entire tab because I believe that program is essential. Now, sure, there are cases where the SRO falls down on the job. I mean, that happened in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you're going to get a quicker response for someone who's on site, who knows the layout of the school, yeah, and really knows, can have their finger on the pulse of the school and knows when something's wrong, mm-hmm, right? And if I had a nickel for every time we were doing commencement addresses and one of the students said, oh, I had such a positive reaction with the SRO, he helped me, you know, invite my girlfriend to homecoming, or, mm-hmm, you know, the experience of taking a wreck and put it out front and talk about how that happened. It's a positive relation with law enforcement, and I think those are exceedingly rare. And so I really want to encourage SRO programs to come back strong.
Yeah, and you use that word encourage because you couldn't force districts to do it, right?
No, yep.
But what would your messaging be to someone like, you know, a place like the Olympia School District, where they have said that this is racist, that it's hurting, you know, you have kids of color who are scared of the school resource officers or whatever it is, and they have decided that is just, I mean, up and down, that's not something that we want.
I would respectfully disagree. I think that, you know, further going into our bubbles is not, yeah, going to solve the problem. The more, you know, cross-pollination we can have between the communities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did in the legislature that I thought was really useful is, and I wish they did it more in D.C. too, is that we have the cafeteria that's right underneath the House floor.
Yeah.
And we would go down, and it was our one place to escape the lobbyists because they couldn't follow us down there.
Oh, they can't? Oh, I like that.
No, it's the one safe space.
Good.
And so we'd go down there. I always made a point of sitting with somebody from the opposite party,
mm-hmm,
right? And just, you know, exchanging stories. And what you find out is that these are good people.
Yeah.
And they have good intentions. And we may disagree about how we get there, but the more you're exposed to each other, the more you're in the same place having conversations together, you build strong relationships that way. And that's how you get to that compromise bill, that common ground bill that's going, yeah, to pass both chambers and everything's going to be happy. I think we need to do that more in our communities. Isolating communities by, you know, preventing law enforcement from interacting with them at all, mm-hmm, I just don't think that's the solution.
Yeah, I agree. So a few closing questions, but in the interest of transparency, not that it's not public, I have donated to your campaign. So I think that's a pretty
appreciate
good indicator that I'm supportive. And it's not that I haven't had good interactions with Chris Reichdahl, but I'm not happy with the state of our public education system. I believe it's going the wrong direction. I think that the academic outcomes show that it is. And one of the other reasons is, because I don't donate to a lot of political campaigns, but, and my husband and I had this conversation, this is the type of race that doesn't get as much attention as it should.
Mm-hmm.
And more, you know, I think school boards and this, it is becoming kind of a battleground for parents, but this is one where I feel like voters need to be keenly aware of what's at stake. So how do we get people to care more about, you know, you got the governor, you got the presidency on the ticket in 2024, how do we get them to care about superintendent of public instruction?
Because I think a lot of people don't realize how much leeway executives have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're seeing it more at the federal level. You know, these executive orders, it feels like they're just jerking the chain left and right. As a new president comes in, they undo all the executive orders of the previous one,
yeah,
move policy in the other extreme. My particular strategy is I want to give as much control to the local districts as possible. And so the policies that are written, the WACS, the Washington Administrative Code, that's established from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, can recognize that and lean towards giving more and more control to local districts. When we were working on the McCleary solution, we went through great effort to make sure that the funding we were sending to the local districts had as much flexibility as possible. Sure, there were categorical funding in cases like reducing class sizes. For the most part, though, they got to spend the money as they saw fit. When COVID hit, that didn't happen. And, you know, I looking back, you know, 2020 hindsight, I wish we had anticipated a lot of the other ways other than financial that the state could take away local control.
Yeah.
But when they started issuing mask mandates and vaccination mandates, you know, when they were looking at closing school, and then some rural districts tried to bring kids back earlier, like a lot of other states were.
Yep.
And not only were they told not to, they were threatened with having their funding cut. They were threatened with having their director's insurance cut, so that if anything went wrong, they would be personally liable.
Mm-hmm.
And so not many districts were willing to stand up to that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
So I put much more focus on local control.
Safe to say that COVID would have probably looked a little different if you had your way in our public school system.
Definitely. I just don't believe that one size fits all really would have applied in this situation. I mean, if you're in Wishtucknow, you have a very different set of priorities than you do in downtown Seattle. And our responses were mandates from on high.
Yeah. One more thing. The WEA is the kind of elephant in the room with education. I mean, they have so much power. It was funny. I had Chris Reichdahl sitting here and I asked him this really off the hand question about, you know, we were talking about the WEA and whether they have too much power. And I said, do they have more power than you? And he goes, no. But then he immediately caught himself. Like, it was like, oh, wait, if they hear that, that's not going to be good for me. And I was sort of laughing about it. I'm like, who are you going to get in trouble with? The WEA is not going to want you to be the guy. I'm pretty confident in that.
Well, I was a prime sponsor for the charter schools fix in the House.
Yes,
they're
yes.
not going to let me get away from that one. That's a very personal thing for them.
Yes. Yeah. So they're going to paint you as, I mean,
an
straight
ultra-mega
from
extremist.
GOP
I can almost write
Hellville,
the hit piece now.
You know what it is? So they have a lot of money.
Yeah, they do.
So how do you combat what you know is going to be the hit?
I talk to parents, and I look at it from the parent perspective. Let me give you an example. So when we went to return back to the classroom, my school district had a strike. You know, they called it a work stoppage, but effectively it was a strike. And they didn't want to go back to the classroom. And I'm not a member of the union. Thanks to the Janus decision, I didn't have to join. I think I might be the only one in my high school
who's not a WEA member. Good for you. Good for you. That's funny.
And so I kept my classes going.
Yeah.
And I got so many positive emails from parents saying, thank you for putting our students first. Because the message that I read out of not going back to the classroom is that our students are not essential. They're not an essential service educating our students. And I couldn't disagree with that more.
Yeah,
I believe it is, and I think we need to put them on the priority. Now, yes, they're a very influential lobbying group. They have the most money. They have the most lobbyists down there. They're a force to be reckoned with. But I think there are a lot more parents out there than there are union activists. And even a lot of teachers, I believe, don't feel like the union speaks for them.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that is going to resonate for parents. And with Initiative 2081 on the ballot, I think it's going to drive a lot of parent turnout. You know, independents and even Democrats who would maybe not vote that year, they're going to be, you know, showing up to vote for Initiative 2081.
Yeah.
And then I have an opportunity to, you know, convince them to vote for me as well. It's a challenge, though, because they're a fierce organization.
Yeah.
The advantage I have is that they've pretty much run everything against me already, right? It's not like they have new material.
Yeah.
They, you know, spent pretty heavily against me in my last two bids to get back to the legislature.
And because of your support of charter schools.
Because of my charter.
Yeah.
That was the most obvious case. But
yes.
At that point, I hadn't spent a lot of time as a teacher. Some of the things that I've suggested as a teacher to improve transparency for parents are definitely not popular with the unions. And I can kind of understand why. For example, when we came back after COVID, we had a period where we were in hybrid teaching. Okay, so half the kids would be working from home, half the kids would be in the class, and we had 6-foot separation for them in the class. And so we got these fantastic cameras installed in all our classrooms.
Yeah.
They actually follow you around the room.
Mm-hmm.
They have beamforming microphones.
Yeah.
And so When we were hybrid, I just started recording all my classes so the kids could go back and watch the recordings. Mm-hmm. After we finished the hybrid, I kept the recordings going. And I find that that transparency into my classroom, into my curriculum, is much appreciated by parents.
Yeah.
But the side effect that I've really appreciated is that the kids, when they know that their parents could be watching, that the principal could be watching, I don't have classroom management problems.
That is so good.
It's worked out beautifully.
I love that. And what teacher would say, I don't want to be filmed? Well, why don't you want to be? There's a lot of, that's interesting. So.
It's tough because I have to be on all the time. And, you know, every time I spent 12 years in the military, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Every once in a while, I'll slip up and let something slide. I have to be very careful to make sure that I'm on at all time because, you know, they'll review the footage and they'll just pick the worst thing that could possibly have happened. And you're judged by your worst moment, which is kind of the way, you know, social media is right now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. We'll obviously have you back on before the election. Congrats on jumping in. I think that this is a tough topic to be running a campaign on because it can be so divisive. And the WEA is going to be, I want to know how much money they're going to spend trying to defeat Chad Magandon. So thank you for jumping in. Thank you for caring enough to do that and for taking the time to chat with us.
Thanks, Brandy.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of the Undivided Podcast. As we get closer to the 2024 election, you can support our coverage for $5 a month by signing up to become a subscriber at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com.